There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I am your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm so glad that you can join me for a little bit of classic cardboard talk, or sometimes it's talk about not so classic cardboard. But this episode, we're going to be focusing on not just one particular year of cards, as we often do, but we're going to be looking at an era of cards. Actually, era is a little too wide open there. I'll say this, a range, it covers 3 years. But if you want to refer to it as an era, it was a very important era or a very important turning point for Bowman. And we're talking about the early 90s Bowman sets, 1991, 92, and 93, all stemming from a purchase of one pack each, which we opened up yesterday. If you go to our YouTube channel, just type in Wax Ecstatic 90s Bowman Pack Breaks, or if you follow us on Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter, just look for the link from yesterday. And look at the cards, look at the differences, and maybe even go into your own card collection if you still have some early 90s Bowman, and you will see how some very, very smart decisions and perhaps a little luck in the market helped Bowman, and by extension Topps, redefine the product and make it a success, which it still is, believe it or not, 31 years after its reintroduction. And if I told you in, say, 1990, so 30 years ago, if I said, you know, Bowman's really going to be hanging in there and it and Topps will be two of the top brands of baseball cards in the year 2020, you'd probably laugh at me and say, Matt, the odds of that are the same as a sweeping pandemic across the world. And then, you know, we'd have a conversation about that. But we look at this particular era of Bowman because not only of the pack purchases that I made a few weeks back, and not only because it's unique to look at a very crucial turning point for Bowman, and they got things just right at the right time, but it also plays off the topic of our last podcast, which was on the rookie card craze. And there's always been a craze for rookie cards, but it really went full steam ahead starting in 1983. And Bowman was able to latch on to a new level of a rookie craze, and they were able to basically exploit it into becoming not just the rookie brand, but the prospect brand. There's a chance that some of the Bowman cards that you pull today for prospects, they may never make it to the major leagues. And of course, that's always the case with any kind of rookie card or prospect card, but you're going way out on a limb on some of these prospects in the hopes that in 4, 5, 6 years, they do become stars. And basically, Bowman's been able to take the rookie card and create kind of the prospect card and get that edge on any competition. Of course, there's not really any competition nowadays, but they've certainly carved a niche out for themselves. And for me, it's interesting, first of all, not to rekindle some memories of some great Bowman cards that I really enjoy looking at. I think some of the 92 and 93s are a little pricey, so I may not really dive into those in my spare time. But it was great to look at these sets. And I really like it personally because I'm somebody who loves looking at the backstory of the success or a failure of a brand. And that's part of my reading. You know, I read a lot of books, and if I'm not reading about sports or if I'm not reading about political history, I'm often reading about businesses and management and brand creation, success and failure. And, you know, I think back to some of the books that I've read throughout my life, books that have covered the creation of Amazon, the creation of Netflix, the creation of Southwest Airlines. All these brands that have either completely turned an industry on its ear, such as Amazon or Netflix, or a brand that survived despite many things working against it. And Southwest Airlines is a great example of that. And I think if you look back to when Southwest Airlines started in 1971, when Amazon started in, what was it, 96, I think, late 90s, when Netflix started back in 2000-ish, I don't think that the people, when they started that and had this general idea of where it was going to go, I don't think that they knew of all the twists and turns to end up where they are today. And of course, because of the coronavirus, all of those brands that I mentioned have to make great changes as well. But they, again, either completely turned an industry on its ear. You know, whatever ease you experience today in online buying, it's because of Amazon. And other brands such as Walmart and Target, you name it, you know, they had to adjust. Or, like a Sears or a Kmart, they died. And same thing, you know, Southwest Airlines. So they didn't turn an industry on its ear, but they created this niche industry, this short-haul, cheap airfare, friendly skies kind of, you know, Texas attitude in a time of, you know, major airlines running the whole operation, the FCC gets in my way, the FAA getting in the way of any expansion plans. But Southwest prevailed in that they didn't completely turn an industry around, but they became the underdog, and they still appeal to the people that, all right, maybe you're not getting the most comfortable seat, and you know, you don't have the fancy food options that some other airlines have, but if you want a cheap airplane ticket somewhere and a smile on the face of the person that gives it to you, then that's a good option. So I'm fascinated by how brands succeed and fail, and there's plenty of examples of brands that have failed. There's certainly plenty of airlines that have done it. Like I said, you can look at Sears and Kmart, now JCPenney, Pier 1, all these companies that are conveniently getting the off-ramp with coronavirus. And it's interesting to see those turning points, those things that they should have done, but they didn't, or things that they did when others weren't doing it. Or sometimes, like I said, it's luck. They just start doing something and it seems to work, and things come together, and all of a sudden they're the leader in the house. And despite opposition, despite people saying, oh, this won't work, or you have to do it this way or else you have no chance, they still find a way to succeed. And I find it interesting looking back at those stories. And I think when you look back at the 91, 92, and 93 swing of cards for Bowman, there were some decisions that were made by the Topps company where, had they chosen a different path, I think Bowman would very much have gone the way of a brand such as Score or Pinnacle, if you will, or, you know, Donruss, Fleer, you know, some of the base sets. A lot of them pretty much vanished off the face of the earth by the mid-90s, or they were greatly altered just to keep up with what was left of the hobby as it was going through a very difficult time. So we're going to dive into that swing in the early 90s, the reintroduction of Bowman in 89, how it completely fell flat on its face and is still kind of showing those repercussions, but how it has definitely survived, and it is a key part of the Topps umbrella. In fact, and you can thank quarantining and people doing a lot more stuff indoors now, and more on this thought in a little bit, because I've seen an uptick of interest in the hobby from people because they're stuck inside most of the time. I think you can thank that as well as that niche that Bowman has created, because when Topps released the first cards of the Bowman set for this year a few weeks back, there was such incredible demand that the Topps store online just crashed and burned for days. And, you know, it's always tough when you have to go, hey, sorry, we didn't plan on, you know, the servers crashing or what have you, and we're so sorry, and we're going to try to do this again tomorrow. But that's kind of the good disaster, if you will, when you have to go, well, it was so successful, it just boiled over. Or, you know, you can think of Ron Burgundy. Well, that escalated quickly. So that's how big Bowman is now. And I think you could trace it all the way back to 91, 92, and 93. Now, I am hoping you're living your quarantine life to the best of your ability as the parts of the country start opening up again. And in most areas are phasing in, just gradually kind of piecing things together, trying to get things moving forward a little bit. I hope you're taking care of yourself, not just physically, you know, doing the old washing hands and putting on the face mask and keeping a proper distance between people, but also mentally as well, emotionally as well. For those of you that are living up north somewhere where the temperatures are starting to warm up a little bit and it's definitely not winter anymore, I hope you're able to get out and get some fresh air. And I hope that Wax Ecstatic has become a pleasant distraction for you. I've seen a lot of new followers on Wax and Gum Stands, a lot of comments from people, some new listeners. So if you've just found us, thank you. I appreciate it. We come your way every 2 weeks, so our next show will be the first Friday of June. That's right. We'll officially, well, not in terms of the Roman calendar, but in terms of everybody mentally, we'll be well into the month of June. I believe it's June 4th. We'll be well into the summer season, I should say. Summer doesn't officially start until a couple weeks after. But for most people, once you get past the Memorial Day weekend, that's unofficially summer. So we'll be a full swing ahead, and I have planned for that next show a look back at some oddball sets. I've mentioned the Topps Big Set, also the Swell Hall of Famer cards. I did pick up a few packs of those, so we'll talk about the Swell brand of cards that came out late 80s, early 90s. And we'll also look at some special, speaking of Hall of Famers, a special set that the Sporting News put out back in the early 1990s. And there is one other very unique set that I found while shopping around for some other stuff on eBay recently. And I don't know if I don't want to give it away yet, because it's one of those sets that I think I was aware of. Never really invested any time or research into it, but when I saw it and did a little research, I was fascinated by this little, and it is a miniature set. It's, I forget how many cards are in it, but it's not that many. But a good example of how big the hobby had gotten in the late 80s, and how, in particular in this case, Topps tried to make it a global phenomenon. So that's all I'm going to say. I think some of you may be understanding what product I'm talking about. But I don't want to give it away yet, and I don't want to lump it into the oddball show. At least not yet. Once I get it in the mail in the next couple of days, I'll take a look at it and decide, does this kind of get grouped in here, or can we do a special show separate of it? Kind of on the fence about it, but I guess you'll have to tune into the next show to find out. Huh? How's that for a tease? So make sure you join us again the first Friday of June. We will be back, and then as I've said before, despite the coronavirus, despite a lot of people being on pause in terms of employment and income and everything, we're going to keep plugging along as well as we can for the foreseeable future. I do have the 94 Topps packs that we will eventually get to. And, you know, we'll just see what other fun things pop up on eBay, perhaps card shows in some kind of limited capacity will be able to open back up. I've got to see if the one or two local card shops that are within a 100-mile distance of where I live are opening up again. But we'll see what surprises come our way, and I always tend to find some and enjoy sharing them with you. So that's the plan for now. We've got the Oddball show coming up in a couple of weeks. We will take a look at the 94 Topps packs a couple weeks after that. And then as we start crawling towards July, we'll see what kind of items we can get our hands on and we can talk about. Speaking of talking about, as I mentioned, a lot of new followers on Wax and Gum Stains. So make sure if you are a new follower or you've been following the show for a while, share the Twitter handle with your friends, and you're more than welcome to tie us into any conversations. And we're open 24/7. We've had some very interesting card conversations over the last couple of weeks here. Also some fun back and forth between me and some listeners. I want to thank Sean Shank, a new listener who says, "Hi, Matt, just started listening to your pod yesterday. It's good stuff. I figured I'd look back into this hobby, and it sounds like I may be one of the many who dropped away due to the strike in the 90s. Well, Sean, we will be talking about that a lot in our 94 Top Show in a couple of episodes. He continues, let's see, he came back either due to shelter in place or for his kids, or both, he asks. And yeah, I think there's been a lot of growth because of both of those. He continues, either way, thanks for putting together such a fun podcast. P.S., I once had Pete LeCocq as a bartender in Scottsdale. To which I replied to Sean, not only thanks for listening, and he did give me permission, by the way, to share this. It was a DM, this little conversation with you, the public. But I mentioned that I recently discovered, this would have been the last few weeks, I recently discovered that Pete LeCocq, one of the great 70s and 80s baseball names, right up there with Rusty Kuntz and many others, of course, I discovered that Pete LeCocq is the son of Peter Marshall. That blew my mind. Now, if you're too young to know who Peter Marshall was, or if you're not like me and you didn't watch a lot of game shows as a kid, Peter Marshall was the host of the Hollywood Squares, not in the late 80s. That's when John Davidson hosted the show. But during the Hollywood Squares glory years, if you will, basically the mid-70s or late 60s maybe, through the early 80s. And then I think Hollywood Squares went syndicated, and that's when Davidson was hosting it. But I'm talking about Paul Lynde as the center square. And Paul Lynde was very entertaining in a Paul Lynde kind of way. And Peter Marshall was just this straightforward. He's still alive, by the way. He's up there too. He's like 92 years old or something. But Peter Marshall had this great radio television voice of the 1960s. And I think I just did research on Peter Marshall just to see if he was even still alive. When not that long ago, I was watching from episode one to episode whatever of Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, one of my favorite comedy variety shows. I was very fortunate. My parents used to let me watch reruns of it when I was like 10 or 11 years old. They used to run on Nickelodeon back in the 80s. And, you know, even before coronavirus, my wife and I, every now and then, if you'd have some free time, we would just go on Amazon Prime and we've just watched it from the pilot episode in 1967 to the last one in the spring of 1973. And Marshall was a guest a couple of times on the last season. So I just, on a whim, I'm like, okay, I wonder if Peter Marshall's even still alive or what he's doing. And that's where I discovered, you know, Peter Marshall's real last name is LeCocq. And Pete LeCocq, the baseball player, is Peter Marshall's kid, which is just mind-blowing to me. So, Sean, thanks again for checking in. Also, a special thank you to some kind comments from Around the Mound, who lives not too far from me in Sarasota. Really appreciate that. Oh, by the way, speaking of upcoming shows, I know I've teased this a little bit. I backed off a little bit, and I will eventually go forward with this at some point. But we will eventually have a discussion with Brad Blukjan on the program. Of course, Brad, the author of the Wax Pack book, and we had him on here back about 3-4 years ago when the show first started, and he was in the process of finishing up the writing portion of the Wax Pack book, and he was working on publication, but the publication took a lot longer to actually happen. And that is part of the success story that Brad has for the Wax Pack book. I'm going to be getting my hands on a copy of it soon. I'm going to read it, even though I have a pretty good feeling for what the book is about, because like I said, we discussed it on this program a few years ago. I will actually read it for myself. We'll get Brad on the phone and we'll talk a little bit, not just about putting the book together and interviewing all these players and tying it into certain aspects of life and, you know, more than just baseball, but just a life story around it. But the publication process, it was a battle for Brad to get this book published. And from what I've seen, it has sold very well. He's gotten a lot of publicity on it. And he's been able to thumb his nose at numerous publishers that turned him down. So, you know, well, a book about baseball cards, who cares? And Brad has been very successful, so I'm very happy to say that we will have him on an upcoming show a little bit later. Also, I want to thank quite a few of our listeners have been helping me out finish up some personal sets of cards, picking up some odd commons here and there to pick up the final pieces of the junk wax sets that I have. So I've got 90 tops checked off. That's done. I've got, I think, 88 and 89 will be done. I'm about two or three cards away from completing my unnecessary third 87 top set. And it's all good because, and I think I've mentioned this before, thanks to some donations from some listeners, as well as some really good deals, I've been able to get on some vending boxes from the 1980s and into the early 90s. I suddenly have about, the foundation laid for eight or nine sets to get worked on. So who knows how long the coronavirus quarantine is going to be, but I will always have some baseball card project at hand. I'm about 100 cards shy of pretty much every set made from, 75 to 86 now. So I'm sure my wife is not thrilled about more baseball cards coming through the house, but I am donating them to Commons for Kids, and we'll do a little plug for them in a moment. One other comment from Topps Pursuit. I forgot in the last episode I asked, what was that first set that kind of got you back into the game? And Topps Pursuit says the 2019 Topps set is what got me back into the hobby. I bought some for my son and picked up a pack for myself. I like the design's nod to the 82 set. Yeah, I noticed that too. It was very subtle, but I thought it was pretty cool. And said, hey, what the heck? I'll build the set for old time's sake. Now, building 76 through 20. See, it's contagious. You start it out of good intentions, and then all of a sudden, boom, there's 10,000 cards in your house again. You're going, what the hell happened here? So thank you for sharing that story, Topps Pursuit. That was a very fun one. And if you would like to share stories, again, Wax and Gum Stains on the Twitter handle is the way to do it. Also, if you would like to share a few bucks with us, it is a soft sell during coronavirus because we're all dealing with cut hours, cut pay, or cut jobs in some cases. But if you do have a couple of bucks handy that you would like to donate to the program, you can do so via PayPal at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, waxecstatic, all one word, paypal.me/waxecstatic. I had a couple of donations recently. Thank you very much for those of you who have donated, whether it's recently or sometimes in the past. As always, all the money, 100% of your donations goes right back into this program, either paying the folks at Audio Boom to host the podcast and send it out all over the RSS feed to Apple Podcast and iHeartRadio and TuneIn and Stitcher and Google Play and all the other platforms that we're on right now, and also to help buy products. So somebody says, hey, you should talk about those swell Hall of Fame cards. I can go looking for them. I can go buy them. I can get them into my hands. I could do a show about them. And they're not that expensive. So even a $5 donation goes a long, long way with this program. And as I've mentioned before, any excess product that we have, we put them in boxes. We send them off to Cards for Kids. Just earlier this week, what was it? Tuesday, I think it was. I sent off a box to Commons for Kids. I'm trying to think how many did I send out. Probably about 3,000 cards. And quite a few 80s and 90s, but also quite a few, several hundred from the 2019-2020 sets as well. And also, as I'm updating these sets from the late 70s and early 80s in my possession, if I've got dupes of those early 80s, they're going right to Commons for Kids as well. So it's good to send a nice little variety pack. So they're getting about 3,000 cards now. I already have my next care package all lined up for them. Got some of those vending boxes ready to go. So probably another 2,000 cards will be heading out their way in the next couple of weeks. So know that the money comes to this program, it gets spent on this program, and it helps benefit Commons for Kids, who do a great job getting baseball cards in the hands of kids, either because the kids can't afford them, or it's just something fun to do, or more importantly, donations to kids' hospitals, cancer centers, places like that where children are dealing with much, much more difficult problems than you or I have to deal with. And nothing brings a smile to a kid's face than some connection to sports. And since there isn't a whole lot of live sports going on right now, it's a whole lot of baseball cards we can share with them. And we thank Commons for Kids for doing what they do. Now let's do what we do here. Let's pick apart some of these cards, in particular the 91, 92, and 93 Bowman sets. Now before we talk about this little three-year swing, we have to go back to the 1950s. As you know, there was a big battle between Topps and Bowman, two separate chewing gum companies who were throwing in baseball cards with their candy back in the late 40s. Well, starting in the early 1950s, they were duking it out, not only in terms of the product and one trying to outdo the other with better designs, more stats, cooler pictures, but in the courts. And there was a lot of court fighting going on between Topps and Bowman in the early 1950s, mostly over player contracts. Topps would go out, in particular Cy Berger, who was the granddaddy of them all at Topps, would go to spring training sites all throughout Florida and Arizona and get players to sign these exclusivity contracts that Topps could only use their likeness on these baseball cards. Bowman had their own set of contracts, and that explains why certain star players appear in Bowman sets but not Topps sets and vice versa in the early 50s. Well, Topps was able to outlast Bowman. Topps had better lawyers, but also the Bowman chewing gum people went through a corporate sale in 1953. They didn't quite have the caliber of lawyers who could fight this out in court and drag it out in court over years. Topps did. So in 1955, Topps buys out Bowman, and that would start the 25-year monopoly of Topps as the lone official baseball card that was officially recognized by both the Major League Baseball and later on, starting in the late 60s, Major League Baseball Players Association. So Topps has this monopoly. We all know the story from here. Fleer starts knocking on the door, starts challenging Topps in court in the 1970s, and that opens up the door in 1981 for Fleer and Donruss. And then as the 80s go on, you've got Sports Flicks, you've got Score that comes about. And then you've got 1989. Now, we recently did a show about Upper Deck and how influential Upper Deck was. And one of the reasons why there's so much love and attention given to the 89 Upper Deck set, first of all, Ken Griffey Jr., card number one. But also, it was flashy. It had style. It was better cardstock. It was those foil wrappers. It was the hologram stickers. You had all sorts of bells and whistles in 89 Upper Deck. Meanwhile, Topps decides to dust off the Bowman brand. Why not, right? You've got all these other cards that are creeping up in the late 80s. It's becoming this global phenomenon. This hobby has turned into a profit-making business for collectors. So Topps decides to take Bowman and basically do a throwback set. Nowadays, throwback, it's all the rage. Hey, I'm one of the biggest people who go out there and spend money on throwback products, in particular the Topps Heritage set. It's one of my favorites. But in 1989, people didn't want throwback, which is kind of odd when you think about it, because you had Field of Dreams that had come out. You know, there's nothing more throwback than shoeless Joe Jackson playing in an Iowa cornfield. And you also had a lot of books that had come out, a lot of movies. This is around the time HBO had When It Was a Game. So there's a lot of this interest in 1930s and 40s and 50s baseball. And you're also just about to cross the threshold into the throwback ballparks. This would have been 3 years before Camden Yards opened up in Baltimore and all of the major league stadiums and eventually minor league and spring training stadiums that would be designed or redesigned to kind of look like they did in the 1930s and 40s. So it's kind of funny when you look back at the throwback effort that Topps tried to put into Bowman, and it makes sense. Basically, the throwback effort was, let's make a 1989 version based very closely to the 1953 Bowman, which you can argue is the best set that was ever made. You could argue, you know, other unique factors in Bowman sets, like the 1955 television set design was pretty unique too. But the simplicity, the cleanness of the 1953 set, and of course you've got a legendary card in that set of Pee Wee Reese and many legendary players. You can look at that set and go, that is like the perfect baseball card. So you can understand why Topps is going, well, let's make this 1989 version of what was so successful in 1953. And it makes a lot of sense. You know, Bowman was kind of the Topps Heritage of the day. And then you had the Topps base set, and the 1989 Topps set is pretty nice design set. And, you know, we've talked about that on a recent show as well. You know, it's just the biggest flaw is that they decided to hold on to the Ken Griffey Jr. card until the traded set, while Fleer and Donruss, and notably Upper Deck, and also Bowman, ironically, all had Ken Griffey Jr. rookie cards that year in their base sets. So it was the right idea, but it was met with a lot of, and for a couple of reasons. Again, Upper Deck was just so flashy and had so much more at the other end of the spectrum. Even though there's always been a throwback crowd, a retro crowd, in 1989, it wasn't quite high-pitched, you know, especially as the hobby is gaining steam here. More people were looking forward than looking backwards. So there just wasn't that much hunger for something that looked like it did in 1953. But as we've discussed on this program before, in fact, when doing podcasts on 89 Bowman, the biggest complaint was the card size. Of course, if you try to replicate 53 Bowman, you have to go back to the old card sizes. Baseball cards weren't reduced to the size that they are nowadays in base sets until 1957. They were slightly larger in 1953, which means all of the cardboard boxes, all of the plastic pages, all of the top loaders that we've been using since basically the 1970s, if you wanted to get an 89 Bowman set, it was obsolete. You had to buy special boxes, special plastic sheets, and it was a real pain in the ass to deal with. So 89 Bowman comes out for all the right reasons, but just goes, or as I've heard one political writer call it, a wet fart in a hurricane. That's a great phrase, by the way. And I think that's 89 Bowman. And there's still a little bit of a stench of 89 Bowman. I think a lot of people see some of the merits in the design. All right, it looks like 53 Bowman on the front. On the back, you've got that unique splits wave showing statistics. But most people just met it with a giant yawn. They just didn't really care. So 89 Bowman stumbles out of the gate. In 1990, Topps refines it a little bit. Okay, let's get the card size down. That's the big complaint. But they were basically going with the same mantra moving forward. All right, we're going to keep it simple. You're just going to have very minimal graphics on it. We're going to keep the splits display of stats on the back. And that's it. Well, 1990, okay, people like it a little better because it fits into the boxes and sleeves. But again, it gets lost in the shuffle. By now, Upper Deck has taken off. People are looking at some of the other base sets that are out there. Topps had a good set in 1990. Fleer did as well. We all know about the mustard or the ketchup Donruss set in 1990. Score had a decent set too. So while people were chasing some of the better looking sets and the more well-known sets, here's Bowman just kind of sitting on the shelf again. And I even opened up a couple packs of 90 Bowman. It was just in one of those boxes of variety packs I'd ordered on eBay once. And at first you're just like, oh, it's 90 Bowman. These are kind of fun. And you open up a couple of them, you look through them, and it's just like, yeah, you know, I just, yeah, you just don't really have it in you to keep them. So, you know, you just kind of put them in the dupe box with everything else. Well, then comes 1991, and this is what I was talking about earlier, about those crucial decisions and, quite frankly, a little bit of good luck that helps out a brand. So Bowman is just flatter than new Coke by 1991. Topps has to change it. They want to keep the brand out there. They think that there's something good about it. There's something redeemable about it, but the public just hasn't latched on. So they decide to make the photography better, make the design a little lighter. I know the fronts of 89s and 90 Bowman, even though they're on gray cardstock with very small white borders, you know, they just kind of look dull. So, you know, they brightened up the display, if you will, a little bit, the front of the 91 cards. On the back, they pull out the legendary green ink that was still left in storage in Topps somewhere and still had the splits way of showing statistics, which, again, I've always liked. A lot of people don't. But they decided to expand the horizons just a little bit rather than just put out a whole bunch of cards that you can get in Upper Deck or Score or Fleer or Donruss, or more importantly for Topps, the Topps base set, or what they were releasing later that year, Topps Stadium Club, the Premier Edition. And that's another thing. You started to have Fleer Ultra was coming out at the same time. You know, all of these other premium sets were starting to show up. They had to find something to put Bowman in. And this is something that they were actually doing in 1989 and 1990. They were featuring some players who, if you flip the card on the back, they didn't have any stats to show because they had no major league experience. So you kind of had this ultra rookie card. Now, I'm not talking about like a Fleer ultra rookie card or the ultra plastic page rookie card, but you know what I mean. You know, there's a rookie card and then there's the prospect card. Whoa, wait a minute. I can have a card of a guy who hasn't played in the major leagues yet. Well, even some of the other big rookie cards, the guys have had some major league experience. Tony Gwynn, Wade Boggs, Don Mattingly, Cal Ripken Jr., Ryan Sandberg, all those big names from the early 80s sets. Yeah, even they had a little cup of coffee a previous season. But there were, in some cases, guys where the only statistics when you flip the card over said, no major league statistics, played in the International League in 1990 or something like that. So it was taking the rookie card, which again really hit its craze and was starting to peak in the early 90s. Remember Todd Van Poppel? Yeah. Hensley Mullins, we're all chasing David Justice cards, Kevin Moss back in the day, Mo Vaughn. All right, everyone's going crazy for these rookie cards. Well, Bowman, whether by design or by just sheer luck, decides to take the rookie fanaticism a step further. All right, you can get a Jeff Bagwell rookie. Well, Bagwell doesn't have any major league experience, but he's a can't-miss prospect, and why did the Red Sox trade him anyways? For Danny Darwin, right? What? Anyways, so you get these guys like Jeff Bagwell and Chipper Jones, these no-brainer, gonna-be-hit players, but they don't have the major league experience yet. And you highlight some of those players. And on top of that, for the players who were MVPs or some other award winners in the minor leagues, you would put this little gold foil MVP stamp in the corner of the card, the front, you know, typically the upper left-hand corner. And all of a sudden, Jeff Bagwell, who maybe in 1991 you didn't know who he was, well, all of a sudden you've got this gold foil stamp on this painting. You know, they didn't use a real picture, this painting of Jeff Bagwell. And you're looking at the stats on the back and, oh, he was an MVP of this league. Well, now all of a sudden there's interest. Oh, this is a can't-miss prospect. And Bowman was able to kind of get a jump on some of the other sets that Bagwell may not have been part of. Now, in 1991, there were Jeff Bagwell cards in other sets, and certainly he became much more of a household name in 1992 as his major league career looked like it was going to get off to a pretty good start and people would buy into those rookie cards. But you have this added incentive to shop through the Bowman packs because there was a chance that you kind of got that pre-rookie card, that prospect card, that maybe other sets had forgotten about. And that is really the hook that Bowman latched onto. Also, what was unique about the 91 set, if I recall correctly, it was released a little later than other base sets. Now, this is very unusual in 1991. Premium sets, so such as Topps Stadium Club, yeah, that came out a little later than the base sets. But Bowman wasn't a premium set. It was a base set, and normally most base sets would be released in mid to late February, just in time for spring training. The Bowman set, if I recall, came out actually mid to late April, I think. And that is unique because Topps was able to get photographers out to the spring training locations and get pictures of players in new uniforms or players who were traded. So no more airbrushing, no more little stamps in the corner that say now playing for or traded to, you know, whatever team. And I remember the 91 set. And in fact, he was utilized on the cover of the boxes. Fred McGriff, the winter of 1990, that was the trade that saw Fred McGriff and the late Tony Fernandez, so weird saying that, going to San Diego in exchange for Roberto Alomar and Joe Carter. A massive trade, one that you could say really truly was a win-win. And of course, the Blue Jays were able to get a little more out of it than the Padres. But the Padres got a couple of good seasons out of both Fernandez and McGriff. And it was rather well-timed, too, since they were hosting an All-Star game in 1992. But in 91, the Padres had also dumped the brown and gold design of their jersey and went with the navy blue and orange and silver, kind of the 1940s design that they had, color palette that they had. And that was big news because the San Diego Padres, as long as they had been a major league team, had always had some kind of brown, gold, tan, orange color combination worked in. So this was your first chance to see players who were traded in their new uniforms or just new uniforms and logos in some cases on baseball cards. Again, 1991, pre-internet. Shocking times. You had to rely on baseball cards or, like I've said before, a magazine, you know, a Sports Illustrated story about the Padres or perhaps, a baseball game on ESPN to actually see this. But back then, if you wanted to watch it on your own time, you had to shuffle through baseball cards. So if you wanted a stack of San Diego Padres cards all wearing their new uniforms, you didn't have to wait for a traded or an update set to come out in September. You had it right there in April. So that was pretty unique, too. And that started setting Bowman a little bit apart from the other base sets. Now, let's flip the page to 1992. As we've said, 92 was the first year where all of the base sets had to up their game to look more like premium sets. So out goes the old gray cardboard, out goes bubble gum, or, you know, for other brands, stickers and puzzle pieces and stuff like that. And you've got the tamper-resistant packaging, which Bowman had already introduced in 1991, so had Topps. And you also have the glossy cardstock. The more gold foil, the better. You know, anything that could add a little bit of shine to the cards. And Bowman definitely did that in 1992. I think the 92 Bowman set is one of the most underrated sets of the junk wax era, not only because of design and not only because of quality, but also because of the rookie class. Of course, you've got Mariano Rivera. You've got some other huge names that are, you know, rookie cards or prospect cards, if you want to call them. And you also have a lot of pictures of these players. Rivera, definitely one of them. And, you know, even some of the players that we pulled from the pack, it was a jumbo pack too of 92 Bowman, that featured the players in relaxed, not just poses, but casual clothing too. And of course, casual clothing in 1991-92 was searing to many eyeballs. It was back then. We knew it back then. We can't say we didn't know any better. But yeah, we were all dressing like Vanilla Ice and Tony, for some strange reason. We all had a collection of Bill Cosby sweaters. Remember those genuine, authentic sweaters? God, we used to wear those in Florida, too. It was 93 degrees, and we were wearing these stupid sweaters just because they were in fashion. Well, anyways, it was a fashion statement back then, too. Hey, let's not just feature these guys wearing baseball uniforms, and it's also a way to skirt around college word marks and stuff like that. All right, we've got some prospects here. Let's just have them, you know, wear some fashionable clothing and just be out on a college campus or have them in a studio. So you've got some pretty interesting pictures of some of these young prospects who were just casually dressed and, you know, just taking more of these kind of glamour shots for Bowman rather than action shots. So for every Mariano Rivera, unfortunately, there is a player that didn't quite survive and make it into the major leagues. And that, of course, is the risk of the prospect card. Either you hit it big and you've got that rookie card of a guy 3-4 years before he's a star player, or you've got an absolute dud. But also in that 92 pack, you've got the gold foil Team USA cards. This is riding high a little bit on the 1988 Team USA, of course, so winning the gold medal in the Seoul Summer Olympics. And it was just an added perk that other sets couldn't exactly brag about. Not that many had any kind of Team USA card. I know the 91 Topps traded set had some. You had Jason Giambi in there as well. But A lot of the other sets didn't quite have the access to some of the Olympic players. So that was a unique thing that was thrown in there too. Now, even though the casual shots, the glamour shots, as I call them, were a staple of the 92 set, I got to tell you, some of the action shots are great too. One of the cards that we pulled from the pack was Barry Bonds, and it is a horizontal action shot of Bonds just taking a swing and probably belting a ball 430 feet the other way. And it is a thing of beauty. And it makes you, you know, a lot of packs from 1992, if you open them, you just kind of look at them and go, okay, that's nice. And you just kind of put them away. This one you're looking at and like, holy cow, that is a thing of beauty. So Bowman really stepped it up in 1992, and they would continue to do so in 1993. In fact, 93 Bowman was looking an awful lot like an Upper Deck product. Very minimalistic design, getting away from the big white borders that you typically saw in the 91 and 92 sets, but having small graphics, still having the splits on the back, which I like, full color photographs, or at least headshots of players on the backs of cards as well. And yes, you had the shiny foil cards in 1993. They were featuring players who were MVPs at minor league levels for the most part in those. And again, you had a pretty good crop of rookies or prospects, players who may not make it to the big leagues for a couple years, standing out in that set. Now, even though I didn't land a Rivera or a Mike Piazza or any other big name there from the 92 or 93 or even 91 packs for that matter, still pretty fun to open up the packs and look at them and do the comparison. You can see the turn being made in 91, a tremendous step forward in 92, and by 93, Bowman had found its game. And even by 94 and 95, you had on the packaging, the Bowman brand was branded the rookie card. So Topps figured out very quickly, all right, that's our niche. Let's run with it. And if you've bought any Bowman product, any current Bowman product or a contemporary Bowman product, I guess I should say in the last 10 or 12 years, you'll notice you not only have a pretty interesting mix of some veteran established players and some prospects who may or may not hit it big, but you've got all sorts of different branches of Bowman. You've got regular Bowman, Bowman Chrome, Bowman First Card, Bowman Autographs, you name it. But if you're somebody who is fanatical about prospects and who is coming up the pipe in a major league organization, Bowman has been your baby now for a good 25 plus years. So that speaks a lot, again, to the success, a little bit of luck, and some very shrewd decisions made by the Topps company in an era where a lot of very bad decisions were made. Never mind just designs or leaving out a hot rookie in the base set that you had to bring in an updated set or a traded set later on in the season. But you had a lot of card companies abandoning base sets for the fancy premium style. Of course, Score is the best example with Pinnacle. Fleer as well, going all full out with the Fleer Ultra set and then just kind of leaving the Fleer base set on the shelf for way too long. All these sets were trying to one-up each other in the premium side. And of course, Topps did it as well, and they did it with Stadium Club too. But Topps was able to find that unique niche with the uber rookie, that big prospect angle with Bowman. They found it at the right time. They exploited it at the right time. And despite the many downs and a few ups in the card industry throughout the 1990s and early 2000s, Bowman has prevailed. So Bowman is not only part of the big rookie and prospect search, they also had a heritage set going on a while back too. I used to buy a lot of Bowman Heritage. They were fun, you know, looking at the cards that were mirrored a lot, like the 52 and 53 and 54 cards, although the people at Bowman very wisely not going with the smaller card size that you saw in some of the late 40s and early 50s Bowman sets. They made them standard size, but still kind of kept to the general design and look and feel of some of those early sets. Now, if you want to go back and buy some 91, 92, 93 Bowman, be prepared to spend a little more than you normally do. Now, 91 Bowman is fairly easy to get. complete factory sets are still affordable. You can find them for the most part for under $20. And I've thought of perhaps buying one on eBay, because while I would love to just buy boxes and boxes of Bowman and go through them, it's a little cost prohibitive. That's because of the Chipper Jones card in particular, but also Jeff Bagwell and Ivan Rodriguez and some of the other big names that were coming through a very talented rookie class in 1991. Also, you should look at some of the young stars that were coming out then too. Ken Griffey Jr., Frank Thomas, Mark McGwire, of course, some of the big studs from the late 80s and early 90s who had already had rookie cards, and in fact, in some cases, in earlier Bowman sets, still carry the weight of the 91 base set rather well. So if you buy a factory set, you can buy one still sealed for a pretty good price. But if you like doing it the old-fashioned way of collecting packs and trying to hand collate a set, going to cost you a little bit just because boxes are sold at a slight uptick from other cards such as Donruss and Fleer and Topps and you name it from 1991. Now, the story is definitely different for 92 and 93 Bowman because of some of the big rookie cards that are there, but also because of the premium quality. And unlike a lot of the other premium sets that came out in the early 90s that just slathered their cards in UV coating and the cards are sticking 30 years later, Bowman didn't do that too much. Now, sometimes the foil cards stick a little bit, so you have to be very careful when separating those when you open up a pack. But for the most part, the 92 Bowman set stands out from the others in that some of the design flaws, some of the well-intentioned designs, but the turned into flaws over the years that have afflicted some other sets, for the most part, have not afflicted 92 Bowman. Except for, I will say, for the cardstock. Even though the cardstock was improved and a tougher white glossy stock, I have noticed that 92 Bowman tends to ding up a little bit easier than some of the other premium sets from the early 90s. So just beware of that. 93 Bowman as well, because you've got some top rookies in there. Not quite as big of a splash as the 92 set, but still some pretty big names and some pretty big foil cards. You know, the value goes up a little bit for those insert cards. You need to, you know, again, be prepared to spend a little money if you're looking for packs. You can find unopened packs and boxes on sale online or in very specific stores, but they are a little pricier than typical boxes and packs that you purchase from 92 and 93 base sets. So they're very neat to collect. If you're able to land a Rivera rookie or a Piazza or one of those other big names from that swath of 3 years of card sets, then good for you. It's a great hit if you can pull one fresh from a pack and it's a 9 or a 10 when you pull it out there. But just beware, because of the chase for some of these now Hall of Fame players, the prices have gone up significantly and they're a little tougher to get if you're on a limited budget. In the meanwhile, there's still plenty of 89 and 90 Bowman out there if you're looking just to add cards to your collection for the hell of it. And before we dive into some of the players that we pulled from these packs, I do want to add that another thing that is pushing the price of cards up a little bit, and I had a friend of mine, Coach Mike, mentioned this. He found a card online that was selling for one price one day, and 2 weeks later it's selling for another and much higher price. Wondering, well, what's going on here? And it's because people are quarantined, people are looking for things to do. And what have we said before? You know, one of the big reasons why we're going through what I call the nostalgia 90s era these days. Anytime you're feeling stressed, anytime you're feeling depressed, anytime you're feeling down and kind of hopeless, well, you know, some people turn to comfort food, all right? You make the grilled cheese and tomato soup, you make the macaroni and cheese, you eat a bunch of cookies, you probably shouldn't. Well, it's the same thing with hobbies. You know, you go back to those baseball cards you collected as kids. And I got to tell you, there was a great story recently on ESPN.com, a couple weeks ago, I think, by Ryan Hawkinsmith. And he's got a great story of why he couldn't let go of some of his junk wax era cards. And there's a very personal reason for it. And I wrote back to him and said, that was a great article. And I strongly encourage any collector to read it, because maybe you don't have the exact same experience that Ryan Hawkinsmith had, but you can probably find some personal reason why, where even in Hawkinsmith's case, where a lot of his cards were destroyed by a freak flood in his basement, He couldn't quite just throw them out. And I think we all have that. And I think that's why, you know, here I am just building these sets from, you know, in particular, the years that I collected when I was a kid. And yeah, it's expanded some of the earlier sets as well. But really, there's no good reason for me to build a 1990 top set. There's really no good reason to build a second 91 top set. There's no good reason for me to build three 87 top sets. But I think we all find a little added comfort in going back to the things that we found joy in when we were younger, when it was a simpler time, we always like to think. And now we know why our parents were so damn stressed out, because adulthood sucks, having to deal with all the nonsense. And I've got a 10-year-old son who, of course, he's kind of at that age where he wants to, you know, be older, look older, act older. And it's just like, kid, be a kid. Don't do this adulthood nonsense until you're 18, okay? But it's funny how you can lean back on some of those positive childhood memories, and kind of like, you know, one of our listeners was saying, Sean Shank was saying earlier, you know, is it because of quarantine or because of introducing cards to his kids that he's doing this? Topps Pursuit said the same thing. You know, you introduce your kids to the hobby and you kind of get back into it. That's how I got back into it, or partially why I got back into it. And, you know, we find some comfort. We find some safety in that. And we also find some sanity too. We find sanity. It is so hard to find sanity in such an insane world these days. And insanity is pumped right into our brains via social media and the internet and television and cable news networks. It's nice to find sanity, even if it is in a Greg Myers 93 Top Stadium Club that you still can't believe you paid $4 for just so that you could complete Series 2. I built the 93 Top Stadium Club set. I had no good reason. I had no intention of doing it. It just happened, and I had fun with it. And nowadays, we need to have fun. So for those who have gotten back into the hobby, or those who have been in the hobby for a while and you're wondering, what the hell are these prices doing going up? It's because there's interest in it. Now, that's not to say the value of these cards is going up. And I want to bring back that word of caution. We brought this up about a year ago when we started talking about 90s nostalgia. Yes, some boxes, packs of cards, single cards, they're being sold for higher prices. But the only people making money off of it are the people who are selling it. Don't fall into that trap that many of us fell into 30 or so years ago, stockpiling all those 89 Upper Deck packs in the hope that they all had Ken Griffey Jr. cards and you would be able to live in a big mansion high atop the hill. Many people who made that assumption are living in a van down by the river. And we really don't want to do that again now, do we? So just be very careful. It's fun to wade back into the hobby. It's fun to collect some of those cards. It's fun to bring your children, sons or daughters. I've seen a lot of girls getting into card collecting too at some of the card shows that I went to before coronavirus came about. So, you know, son or daughter, it's a great way to get them into the hobby. And it's a great way to kind of reintroduce yourself to it. But don't be surprised if you pay a little more for some of those late 80s and early 90s packs than you wanted to. And also don't be surprised if the Greg Jeffries 89 Topps card is still selling for a nickel a piece, no matter how many you collect and no matter how shiny that Future Star logo is on his card. All right, let me stop thumping into all of my equipment here, and let's dive into the biographies of some of these players, because I've got some pretty interesting stories about some of the players that we found. Now, we normally take four cards from the packs or the collection of cards that we're looking at, and because I had two regular packs of 91 and 93 and a jumbo pack of 92, I decided to take one from 91, two from 92, and one from 93. Now, the one card that I pulled from the 91 pack, it was the first card on the pack. No, not the Lenny Harris card that had the bubblegum stuck to it. No, this was one of those gold foil MVP cards where you get it out of the pack and you go, ooh, who is this? I don't know, but I'm going to put him in a top loader because he's an MVP somewhere. We're talking about Tim Howard, who actually played professionally for 15 years, but never played in a major league game. Not quite Moonlight Graham here, but close. Very close. I want to thank the people at the Baseball Reference Bullpen for doing a lot of research on Tim Howard, because you can't find a whole lot out there. He was selected in the fifth round of the 1988 amateur draft by the New York Mets, and he would very quickly move his way up through the Mets farm system. Now, where did he get that gold MVP foil honor on the 91 Bowman SIP? Well, it started in 1990. He is playing in the South Atlantic League for the Columbia Mets, and he had a banner season. 323 batting average for the season, 11 triples, 10 home runs, 89 RBI. He leads the South Atlantic League in average. In fact, he was just a nose ahead of Brooke Fordyce, who was the runner-up, and he was an absolute star in the Mets system. And if you're a Mets fan, you know that prior to David Wright, and even he's been dealing with health issues over the last several years, there has always been a search for a solid, longtime third baseman for the New York Mets. So if you're a Mets fan and you're looking at this guy in the South Atlantic League and he's just having the season that he's having, you're thinking, hot damn, in a couple of years, this guy's finally going to solve our issues at third base. Now, he was actually honored by Baseball America as the number six prospect in the league, trailing such more notable names as Fordyce, along with Ryan Klesko and Tim Pugh, who we found in one of our Bowman packs. Now, even though he had this outstanding 1990 season, it just went away in 1991. He's with the St. Lucie Mets and the Williamsport Bills, averages around 258 throughout that season. He is moved to the outfield, hits 273 in Binghamton in 1992, and then he's just kind of bouncing around between Binghamton and Norfolk, and then he starts bouncing around from organization to organization. Basically, his time with the Mets ends in the 1993 season. He is with the Mexico City Tigers in 1994, and I found this fascinating. In 1995, he was a replacement player for the Boston Red Sox. That is, before the strike was settled. Now, fortunately for him, he impressed enough people in the Boston organization to where they signed him to a minor league deal with the Pawtucket Red Sox. But even though he had a pretty solid 38-game stretch with Pawtucket, he gets sent to the Chicago White Sox AAA affiliate, the Nashville Sounds, where he just had an absolute dud of a second half of the season, only hit 233. And then after that, he is just going all over the world. He's in Amarillo in 1996, also in 1997. In fact, had another banner year. He was an all-star shortstop in 1997. Continues in Amarillo in 1998, then moves around to Taiwan and also Yuma. The Yuma Bullfrogs was where he would wrap up his professional career. And it all wraps up in 2002. So it's quite amazing. Here's a guy who was the South Atlantic League MVP in 1990, the Texas Louisiana League with the Amarillo Dillas in 1998. And again, he had some pretty spectacular seasons and was a top prospect for many years. Just was never able to make it to the big leagues. So it goes to show, sometimes when you've got those MVP cards, those, you know, going out on a limb for a prospect player, sometimes you're going to end up with a miss and not a hit. Although, again, you would think, as close as he came to getting to the big leagues with the Red Sox or impressing people in the Mets organization in the early 90s, he just didn't get that opportunity, which is a shame because he came so close, but not close enough to make it to the bigs. Now, one of the two cards that we pulled from the 92 pack, and I said this in the video, I went, oh, Brian Taylor, here's a guy, talk about a wasted opportunity. A little bit of it is bad luck, a little bit of it is just poor choices. Now, you look at Tim Howard, and it was just bad luck. Just when you thought he was going in the right direction, he would go backwards. He could never find the right position, never find the right parent team, could never crack the big league lineup. Well, according to Scott Boras, who would be the agent for Brian Taylor, he was the best pitcher he had ever seen in high school, certainly at least up until that time. A Beaufort, North Carolina native, he was selected with the first overall selection in the 1991 draft by the New York Yankees. This was a guy who came from, let's say, humble, hardscrabble beginnings. His dad was a mason. His mother worked at a local seafood plant as a crab picker. He was the second of four children and was an absolute stud at the local high school in Beaufort. He had a win-loss record of 29-6 and earned run average of 1.25, and he struck out 213 hitters in 88 innings pitched, all while walking 28. And his fastball, this is in high school, his fastball was clocked in the upper 90s. So no surprise, the Yankees would take him first overall. But then again, you've got Scott Boras involved here. The Yankees offering the typical entry-level contract, $300,000 to sign Taylor. And of course, Boras says, well, hey, last year, the top-rated high school pitcher, Todd Van Poppel, got $1.2 million to sign with Oakland. So why should you get $300,000 to be property of the Yankees? So the Taylor family follows Boras' advice, and they're holding out for a three-year, $1.2 million contract. This despite the fact that Taylor, while he was an outstanding athlete, was a terrible student. He really struggled in high school and couldn't get any good collegiate offers because he had such bad grades. Well, George Steinbrenner, who in 1991 was still technically suspended by Major League Baseball from running the operations of the Yankees, he spoke out through the media and he said that if the Yankees let Taylor get away, quote, they should be shot. End quote. So the Yankees signed Taylor for $1.55 million on August 26, right before he was going to start his college career. Now, in the early 90s, the Yankees were not very successful, even though they were happy George was not in the office. Weren't able to put together very good teams on the field at the time. So the Yankees organization decided that they were going to take their time with Taylor, and they started him out in the lower levels of the minor leagues. Now, this is some of the bad luck for Taylor. He was already being knighted as the next great pitcher, the next Dwight Gooden, and in fact, he was the top prospect by Baseball America even before his pro career started in 1992. He would start with the Fort Lauderdale Yankees, performed extremely well there, and in 1993 moved up to the AA Albany Colony Yankees, where they were working on some breaking pitches so that the fastball could be complemented with another decent pitch. Now, he was named the second best prospect behind some kid named Larry, or Chipper, Jones. And Taylor again performed very well in Double-A, 13-7, 3.48 earned run average, 150 strikeouts. And he still had some control issues, walked quite a few batters, but the Yankees were still, for the most part, pretty pleased with how he was going. Now, much like brands make poor decisions or sometimes good decisions, Taylor made an extremely poor decision, one of many, actually, in the winter of 1993. Despite a good but not great season at AA, the Yankees intended for Taylor to pitch in AAA in 1994, and that was, of course, with the Columbus Clippers, and eventually making it to the major leagues in 1995, and the Yankees really wanted Taylor to take part in the Fall Instructional League to work on some of his fundamentals. Well, Taylor said, no thanks, and he goes back home to North Carolina. That is where fate steps in here. December 18th, 1993, according to the New York Times, Taylor defending his brother Brendan in a fight with a man who Brendan apparently fought before, a guy named Ron Wilson. Well, Wilson has a friend who is named Jamie Morris, who gets in an altercation with Taylor. And according to the story here, Taylor tried to throw a big punch at Morris, which misses and causes a major shoulder injury. So the Yankees find out about this. The team doctor takes a look at the shoulder, and according to the doctor, it is the worst injury he had ever seen. So Taylor has to undergo surgery to basically reconstruct his throwing arm in 1994, comes back in 1995, and was never the same. They started him out at the Gulf Coast League, and not only had he lost zip on his fastball, but he had control issues, was giving up run after run after run, and even though the Yankees were working on him, he was just an absolute disaster by the late 1990s. The Seattle Mariners would take a flyer on him in 1998. He took part in extended spring training, but because of his inconsistency was released. And after the 1999 season, the Indians take a look at him, sign him with the Class A Columbus Red Sticks. But in only 2 2/3 innings, pitched over 5 games, Taylor gives up 5 hits and 9 walks for a rather immaculate earned run average of 27.00. But wait, there's more. After falling on hard times with his major league career in shambles, Taylor would move to Raleigh, North Carolina. He was working as a package handler for UPS, also as a beer distributor, and was helping his dad, who again was a mason at home, kind of helping out with the family business. In March 2012, Taylor was charged with cocaine trafficking after undercover narcotics agents purchased a large quantity of cocaine and crack cocaine from him over a period of several months. He was federally indicted on cocaine trafficking, pled guilty, and was sentenced to 50 months in prison, followed by 3 years supervised release. He was released from prison back in September of 2015. That's a great could have, should have, would have been, who knows? But we all know that Taylor, unfortunately, failed miserably. Meanwhile, that other guy who was right there with him in a lot of Baseball America guesswork of where prospects are, Chipper Jones, of course, carrying on with a Hall of Fame career in the end. All right, who else did we pull from the 1992 set? Well, one of the great names, not only of the early 1990s, but because of Harry Caray. Of course, Harry was fond, accidentally, I'm sure, of messing up names. And one of my favorite names that he messed up was Brett Barbary, or as he called him once, Brett Barbecue. So Brett Barbecue, Brett Barbary, Long Beach, California native, we pulled his card here, a star at Gehr High School, I believe that's how you say it, G-A-H-R, in Cerritos, California. He was enrolled at the Cerritos College, a junior college, and then transfers to USC to play baseball for the Trojans. And he is part of USC's great 1988 season. He's part of the All-Pacific 10 Conference's first team. And he wins some hardware in 1988, wins a silver medal at the 1988 Baseball World Cup and a gold medal as part of the U.S. team in Seoul in 1988. 1988, also a great year for Barbary as he was selected in the Major League Draft by the Montreal Expos in the 7th round, works his way up through the minor league system rather quickly, in fact, makes his big league debut in June of 1991, had a pretty solid 1991 season. 353 batting average and 136 at-bats, playing mostly third base for the Expos. That allowed them to move the veteran Tim Wallach across the diamond to first base. And much like a lot of these other prospects that we've been talking about, be it Tim Howard or Brian Taylor before his injury, looking pretty good here. And there's some hope that, all right, we found a replacement for Tim Wallach and another young star in what was then a rebuilding Montreal Expos team. Well, in 1992, Barbary really struggled. Had a .232 batting average for the season and actually spent quite a few months of the season in the minor leagues. So the shine kind of wears off on Barbary for the Expos. So they leave him exposed in the 1992 expansion draft. And he's the third player chosen by the Marlins, part of the inaugural team that played in 1993. And it is of note that Brett Barbary hit the first hit in Marlins franchise history on opening day, a single off of Oral Hershiser. Also in 1994, Barbary hit the first inside the park home run for the Marlins. Now, some other unique feats by Barbary in 1994. In May, he somehow got chili pepper juice in his eye when putting in his contact lenses. I'm assuming he had chili pepper juice on his fingers and he went to put his contacts in his eyes and it burned up. I know of other people who've done similar goofs. I'm hoping he didn't put his lenses in chili pepper juice. But anyways, he was actually temporarily blinded and missed a game because of that. Now, he had some ups and downs. Like I said, that first hit, first inside the park home run, had a pretty good year in 93 with a .277 batting average. But he also led the National League in errors committed by a second baseman in 1994. So even though offensively he was pretty good, the Marlins decided to move on from Barbary because he was a little bit of a defensive liability. They trade him to the Baltimore Orioles for Jay Powell shortly after the 1994 season, would start at second base for the Orioles, but had some trouble adjusting there. Becomes a free agent after the 1995 season, signs on with the Chicago Cubs in 95, has a pretty nondescript has a pretty nondescript 96 season, and basically his career peters out in 1997 in the minor leagues as a member of the Texas Rangers organization, although playing for the Oklahoma City Redhawks. Now, you may also know Brett Barbary better as Mr. Jillian Barbary. Of course, Jillian Barbary, his wife for several years in the late 90s and early 2000s. They split up, I want to say, 2002, 2003, something like that. Jillian Barbary would be known as the weather girl on the NFL pregame show for Fox, also a frequent guest on Best Damn Sports Show on Fox about 10, 15 years ago. She's been dealing with some adversity, not only a second divorce, also a very serious case of breast cancer, which she is a survivor of. And also Brett Barbary's dad, Ed Barbary, played professional baseball in the minor leagues. He currently owns and operates a baseball facility in Santa Clarita, California. And last but certainly not least, it was so funny opening up the 93 pack and the first card that we see, Cal Eldred. What was it? Just a couple of shows ago, we had the packs that had Ben McDonald in there and Dave Fleming. And I mentioned how McDonald and Fleming and Cal Eldred, they were three of the big names of potential star pitchers who all just kind of fizzled out. And while McDonald's career lasted longer than Fleming, you know, Fleming went into elementary school teaching, where he's been doing that for about 15 years. McDonald went on to be a broadcaster. Well, Cal Eldred's done all right for himself, despite a career that didn't quite live up to expectations after a pretty solid start in the early 1990s. Now, Cal Eldred is a native of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, attended the University of Iowa, and he was selected in the first round of the 1989 amateur draft by the Milwaukee Brewers, very quickly makes his debut with the Brewers in 1991. And after a brief cup of coffee with the Brewers at the end of the 91 season, he starts the 1992 season and has a great start with an 11-2 win-loss record. He was the pitcher of the month in the American League in September. Also finished fourth in the American League Rookie of the Year award voting. So again, 91, 92, 93, if you're pulling a Cal Eldred card, you probably put it in the same stack with your Dave Fleming and your Ben McDonald cards, because you're thinking, okay, these are some of the young arms that are coming up here. Now, despite that great 1992 season, struggled a little bit in 1993, as he did lead the American League in games started and innings pitched. However, had a 16-16 record and a 4.01 earned run average. Now, part of that win-loss record is really more the Milwaukee Brewers were starting to flail a little bit after some moderate success a couple seasons earlier. But even though he had 180 strikeouts to 99 walks, wasn't able to keep the runs down. And that would happen again in 1994. Again, a win-loss record at 500, going 11-11, earned run average of 4.68, and again, leading the American League in game started. Had some injury issues in 1995 and 1996. Finally got back into the regular rotation in 1997 with a 13-15 record and a 4.99 earned run average over 34 starts. And again, dealing with shoulder injuries and ineffective pitching over the next couple of years, his time with Milwaukee would end. After he got traded to the Chicago White Sox, along with Jose Valentin, for Jamie Navarro and John Snyder, January of 2000. He only started 22 games over 2000-2001 seasons, as he had a 10-2 record in 2000. He was the American League Pitcher of the Month in June, but he would have, again, some arm issues, missed all of the 2002 season due to injury, and he would sign on with the St. Louis Cardinals after the 2002 season. Actually pitched in relief for the Cardinals in 2004, made a couple of appearances in the World Series, which of course they lost to the Boston Red Sox, and he would then announce his retirement as a player following the 2005 season. He was the recipient of the Cardinals' Good Guy Award, the Darryl Kyle Good Guy Award, and by all accounts, he certainly is a good guy. So even though his major league record may not have lived up to expectations, 4.42 earned run average, 86-74 record, and 939 strikeouts over how many seasons here? 14 seasons, many of them injury plagued. Still very well liked around the big leagues. Now, much like Ben McDonald, he first went into the broadcast booth. He was a color analyst, studio analyst for the Big Ten Network about 10 years ago. And then he joined the Cardinals front office. He was a special assistant to the GM, also a minor league instructor. And he is currently the pitching coach for the cross-state rival Kansas City Royals, a position that he was named to heading into the 2018 season. By the way, Cal Eldred's son, CJ, is also making his way through the minor leagues after, like his dad, playing at Iowa, has been able to get a little bit of experience in the lower minor leagues. Nothing to write home about, but cool to see the son of a former major leaguer working his way up, hopefully to big league dreams as well. And maybe, just maybe, I've got to look through the Bowman checklist. Maybe there's a CJ Eldred Bowman card that's out there because if CJ Eldred makes it, it's going to be a few years, but you know that Bowman's going to be on top of it, something that they started doing nearly 30 years ago, and it has paid off handsomely for Bowman. Of course, Bowman being part of the Topps family for well over 60 years now helps out. It's not like they were truly gone away, and you've got the backing of Topps financially, and of course promotion and marketing. It's not like they were truly competition like Fleer or Donruss was back in the day, but some very smart choices made by Bowman to focus on the prospects, the guys who were a little further away than some of the guys who were perhaps labeled as rated rookies or future stars, as you would see in other base sets. And it was also very wise for the later release date, so you didn't get lost in the shuffle of all the other base sets that were coming out. And also changing with the times, too, of updating card quality, photo quality, all the other bells and whistles like gold foil or shiny foil, as well as tamper-resistant packaging and limited press runs as well. It's amazing to think that had Bowman slash Topps gone another way, Bowman may have again died, but not because it was overtaken by a rival like they were in the 1950s, but Bowman may have died a death very similar to some other base sets in the mid-90s. If they had decided to just become kind of like everybody else, they didn't though. They found that niche, they used it, it came at the right time as you had a new class of exciting young players coming up in the early 1990s, those star players who would become Hall of Famers in many cases in the mid to late 90s. They were able to find that niche at the right time, and Bowman survives. So even though it came out of the gate stumbling, to say the least, it is still not very like those 89 and 90 sets. You started seeing that turn in 91, the huge step forward in 92, and then a pretty solid product in 93, and some great card sets have been released ever since then. So that's our look at the early 90s Bowman, a huge turning point for them and for a special sector of the hobby that still pays back Bowman in dividends these days. And as I mentioned, 91 Bowman, relatively easy to get. I would prefer buying a factory set that is still sealed. It's a lot cheaper, a lot easier to get a hold of than buying the boxes and packs. However, nothing wrong with opening up some old Bowman packs from 91. That is one of those sets that I regretted getting rid of all those extra cards I had many, many years ago when I did my big purge. And it still holds pretty strong today, not just because of the strong rookie class and young star class, but I still like the design. I like the improvements over the previous couple of sets. And I think even if you hold up 91 Bowman to some of the other base sets in 91, certainly better than Fleer, better than Donruss. You can argue it's better than Score. And I think it's right up there. It's held up fairly well over the decades. 92 and 93, a little harder to find those, but if you've got the money and the time, definitely worth your effort, not only because they're great sets, But you can land some pretty big rookie and prospect cards in those sets. And especially if you're lucky enough to end up with a foil version of one of those cards, you've got a few extra bucks in your pocket because of it on the resale end of things. Well, that'll wrap up our program for this week. Want to thank you again for joining me. Make sure you come back again on the first Friday of June. We will be back as we take a look at some of the oddball cards that have come out, and I've had some listener requests to talk about a few of these. So we will look at, in particular, the Swell Hall of Fame series from the late 80s and early 90s. We'll also look at the Topps Big Series from that same time period. And also from that time period, the Sporting News Hall of Fame series. Some pretty interesting cards that came out of that series as well. And like I said, there's that one other item I may or may not talk about it in that show. You'll have to listen to the show because I should be receiving this item shortly. And once I look at it and determine where it kind of fits in, we'll either have a separate show about it or we'll kind of put it in with all these other interesting cards. And don't forget, we've got 94 Tops coming up down the road, an interview with Brad Blukjan, author of the Wax Pack book, and a whole lot more fun. So make sure you keep joining us every other Friday. We drop these podcasts at noon Eastern, video breaks the day before on YouTube, and we will also be taking your requests and suggestions and ideas as well. You can comment at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Open 24/7 for your commentary, questions, thoughts, ideas. We certainly greatly appreciate them. And again, if you're one of the lucky ones battling through the tough economic times, you got a couple bucks you want to throw our way, we appreciate all donations at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Every penny goes right back into the show. We can find some more fun cards to talk about right here on the program. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic, and we will see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.